Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. Coming up, Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. We also have Words and Their Stories from Anna Mateo. And we close the show with an American story. But first,
Spanish scientist Pilar Bosch has found a way to use bacteria to repair 18th century paintings. Bosch, a microbiologist, tells Reuters she got the idea for the method while considering possibilities for a paper toward her doctoral degree. During this process, she discovered someone else's paper that suggested bacteria can be used to restore artworks. At around the same time, Bosch learned that her mother was struggling to find a good method for restoring 18th century paintings. The paintings by Spanish artist Antonio Palomino sat in Santos Juanes, one of the oldest churches in the city of Valencia. Bosch said her mother, Pilar Roig, noted how difficult the restoration process at the church was. One reason was the glue used to remove the paintings from the walls in the 1960s. The substance was nearly impossible to remove completely. My mother had a very difficult problem to solve, and I found a paper about bacteria used to clean frescoes in Italy, Bosch said. A fresco is a kind of painting that often appears across a large wall. Bosch added she decided to write her doctoral paper on the same subject. That was more than 10 years ago. Today she gets to work with her mother on the church restoration. They are using the bacteria method to remove glue from artworks. The $4.46 million project is being financed by local organizations. The process involves feeding small amounts of the glue made from animal collagen to the bacteria. After a time, the bacteria begins to naturally produce enzymes to break down the glue. The mother-daughter team then mixes the bacteria with a natural algae-based substance called a gel and places it onto the paintings. They say that after about 3 hours, the gel mixture is removed, leaving the paintings glue-free. Bosch's mother, now 75, noted that in the past, restorers of artworks had to use traditional cleaning methods that took hours and damaged the painting. She noted that several other relatives in the family also work in art restoration. Bosch agreed, saying the work certainly runs in the family. Bosch has also used her bacteria removal process in other restoration projects in Italy and Spain. And she is now training other scientists to use a different kind of bacteria to clear walls of painted graffiti.
Fields of tall corn plants are a common thing to see in the Midwest United States in late summer. They are as much a part of rural America as big red barns and cows. But soon, tall corn plants might become shorter, replaced by plants only half as tall. Cameron Sorgenfrei is a farmer in the Midwestern state of Iowa. He has been growing newly developed short corn for several years. His neighbors sometimes have questions about his smaller corn plants. As you drive across the Midwest, maybe in the next 7, 8, 10 years, you're going to see a lot of this out there, Sorgenfrei said. I think this is going to change agriculture in the Midwest, he added. Bayer Crop Science developed the short corn and tested it on 12,141 hectares in the Midwest. One promise the company made to farmers was a kind of corn that could survive powerful windstorms. The corn is not only shorter, but it also has a larger base. It can withstand winds of up to 80 kilometers per hour. The smaller plants can grow closer together than taller kinds. That means farmers can grow more corn on the same amount of land, which increases their profits. This will help farmers facing lower corn prices in recent years. The smaller plants could also lead to less water use. Last year, American farmers grew more than 363 million metric tons of corn. Most was used for animal feed, the fuel additive ethanol, or exported to other countries. Scientists have long tried to develop better kinds of corn plants. But it has become more important for corn to grow even in very hot weather or where there is a lack of rain. Strong winds are another danger. In August 2020, a strong windstorm in the Midwest caused $11 billion in damage. It flattened both trees and corn plants only weeks before harvest time. I'm Jill Robbins.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Martha about the usage of two adverbs commonly used in spoken English. Dear teacher, I'm wondering if you could help me explain the difference between obviously and apparently. Thank you, Martha. Thank you for writing to us, Martha. I'm happy to answer this question. Let's look at the adjective form of these words first. If something is obvious, that means it is easy to see or understand. For example, it is obvious that an elephant is bigger and heavier than a dog. But some things are only obvious if you have enough experience or knowledge. For example, if a car needs fixing, it may be obvious to a skilled worker what repairs are needed. But the repairs might not be obvious to a person who lacks experience with cars. The adjective apparent also describes something that is easy to see or understand. But we probably use the word apparent less often than the word obvious. Apparent can sound a little more formal than obvious in some situations. Both obvious and apparent can be followed by the preposition to plus an object pronoun, as in the following examples.
It's obvious to me that he is unhappy. It was apparent to him that no one in the office had the right skills for the job.
Next, let's look at the adverbial forms. obviously, and apparently. Unlike the adjective forms, these two words differ in terms of how easily we can understand or know something. When we use the word apparently, we are expressing the idea that we think we know something is true. However, this idea is usually based on information we have heard or read rather than our own direct experience. For example, if you say, "Apparently, he's not a very good teacher," that means you have heard reports that the person is not a good teacher. At the same time, you do not know for sure if it is true. That is because you do not have direct experience yourself with the teacher. On the other hand, if you say, "He's obviously not a very good teacher," that means you have, or think you have, enough information to be sure that you are correct. It also means you think others should easily understand or agree with what you are saying. We can use obviously or apparently as the first word in a sentence, followed by a comma, as in,
"Obviously, we need to practice more if we want to improve. Apparently, it's hard to find a good restaurant in that area."
We can also place these adverbs next to the verb.
"She apparently needs a lot of help." "He obviously feels very strongly about this issue."
What are your questions about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore words and expressions in the English language. We give examples, notes on usage, and sometimes we use them in short conversations. Today, we talk about the sweet dish at the end of a meal, the dessert. One of the most famous kinds of dessert is pie. With a buttery crust and sweet fillings, like apple, berries, or banana cream, a well-made pie is a dreamy food indeed. And that gives us the expression, pie in the sky. Imagine a perfect pie coming down to you from the sky. That is like a dream. And a pie in the sky is a dream too. Anything described as pie in the sky is fun to daydream about, but is very unlikely to happen. When we act in a pie in the sky manner, we are being foolishly optimistic. Any industry or area of life can have pie in the sky ideas. So you can use this expression for different situations. In business, let's say a company has lost money for 2 straight years. But the company chief promised increased earnings in the coming year. Her claims, as they say, were simply pie in the sky. She had no business plan or data to support them. An unpublished writer may have pie-in-the-sky dreams about her book being turned into a multi-million-dollar film project. A teacher may have pie-in-the-sky wishes that all his students complete their homework on time. Pies in the sky are empty promises or empty wishes. They are wishful thinking. They are as unlikely as tasty pies falling from the sky. American English has another similar expression, pipe dream. The expression is also used to describe a plan, hope, or wish that is highly unlikely to happen. However, this expression does not come from a tasty bakery. Word experts say it started in opium dens. Here, people would smoke opium in long pipes and then fall into a dreamlike state where nothing seemed real. Now, let's hear two friends using the expressions pipe dream and pie in the sky.
Hey, did you hear about Sarah? She's moving to Spain.
Really? Last week, she told me she was having trouble paying her rent.
Well, she told me this morning that she's moving to Madrid to open a bakery.
Sarah? Open a bakery? That sounds like a total pie in the sky to me. She can't even make toast.
You know, it sounded like a pipe dream when she told me. She didn't have details, just a lot of dreamy talk.
Well, if she wants to turn her pie-in-the-sky bakery dream into a reality, I'd advise her to do one thing first, learn how to bake.
And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Our story today is called A Municipal Report. It was written by O. Henry and first published in 1904. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
It was raining as I got off the train in Nashville, Tennessee. A slow, gray rain. I was tired, so I went straight to my hotel. A big, heavy man was walking up and down in the hotel lobby. Something about the way he moved made me think of a hungry dog looking for a bone. He had a big, fat, red face and a sleepy expression in his eyes. He introduced himself as Wentworth Caswell, Major Wentworth Caswell from a fine Southern family. Caswell pulled me into the hotel's barroom and yelled for a waiter. We ordered drinks. While we drank, he talked continually about himself, his family, his wife, and her family. He said his wife was rich. He showed me a handful of silver coins that he pulled from his coat pocket. By this time, I had decided that I wanted no more of him. I said goodnight. I went up to my room and looked out the window. It was 10 o'clock, but the town was silent. A nice, quiet place, I said to myself as I got ready for bed. Just an ordinary, sleepy, southern town. I was born in the South myself, but I live in New York now. I write for a large magazine. My boss had asked me to go to Nashville. The magazine had received some stories and poems from a writer in Nashville named Azalea Adair. The editor liked her work very much. The publisher asked me to get her to sign an agreement to write only for his magazine. I left the hotel at 9 o'clock the next morning to find Miss Adair. It was still raining. As soon as I stepped outside, I met Uncle Caesar. He was a big old black man with fuzzy gray hair. Uncle Caesar was wearing the strangest coat I had ever seen. It must have been a military officer's coat. It was very long, and when it was new, it had been gray. But now, rain, sun, and age had made it a rainbow of colors. Only one of the buttons was left. It was yellow, and as big as a 50-cent coin. Uncle Caesar stood near a horse and carriage. He opened the carriage door and said softly, "Step right in, sir. I'll take you anywhere in the city." "I want to go to 861 Jasmine Street," I said, and I started to climb into the carriage. But the old man stopped me. "Why do you want to go there, sir?" "What business is it of yours?" I said angrily. Uncle Caesar relaxed and smiled. "Nothing, sir, but it's a lonely part of town. Just step in and I'll take you there right away." 861 Jasmine Street had been a fine house once, but now it was old and dying. I got out of the carriage. "That will be $2, sir," Uncle Caesar said. I gave him two $1 bills. As I handed them to him, I noticed that one had been torn in half and fixed with a piece of blue paper. Also, the upper right-hand corner was missing. Azalea Adair herself opened the door when I knocked. She was about 50 years old. Her white hair was pulled back from her small, tired face. She wore a pale yellow dress. It was old, but very clean. Azalea Adair led me into her living room. A damaged table, three chairs, and an old red sofa were in the center of the floor. Azalea Adair and I sat down at the table and began to talk. I told her about the magazine's offer. She told me about herself. She was from an old southern family. Her father had been a judge. Azalea Adair told me she had never traveled or even attended school. Her parents taught her at home with private teachers. We finished our meeting. I promised to return with the agreement the next day and rose to leave. At that moment, someone knocked at the back door. Azalea Adair whispered a soft apology and went to answer the caller. She came back a minute later with bright eyes and pink cheeks. She looked 10 years younger. "You must have a cup of tea before you go," she said. She shook a little bell on the table, and a small black girl, about 12 years old, ran into the room. Azalea Adair opened a tiny old purse and took out a dollar bill. It had been fixed with a piece of blue paper, and the upper right-hand corner was missing. It was the dollar I had given to Uncle Caesar. "Go to Mr. Baker's store, Impey," she said, "and get me 25 cents worth of tea and 10 cents worth of sugar cakes, and please hurry." The child ran out of the room. We heard the back door close. Then the girl screamed, her cry mixed with a man's angry voice. Azalea Adair stood up. Her face showed no emotion as she left the room. I heard the man's rough voice and her gentle one. Then a door slammed, and she came back into the room. "I am sorry, but I won't be able to offer you any tea after all," she said. "It seems that Mr. Baker has no more tea. Perhaps he will find some for our visit tomorrow." We said goodbye. I went back to my hotel. Just before dinner, Major Wentworth Caswell found me. It was impossible to avoid him. He insisted on buying me a drink and pulled two $1 bills from his pocket. Again, I saw a torn dollar fixed with blue paper with a corner missing. It was the one I gave Uncle Caesar. How strange, I thought. I wondered how Caswell got it. Uncle Caesar was waiting outside the hotel the next afternoon. He took me to Miss Adair's house and agreed to wait there until we had finished our business. Azalea Adair did not look well. I explained the agreement to her. She signed it. Then, as she started to rise from the table, Azalea Adair fainted and fell to the floor. I picked her up and carried her to the old red sofa. I ran to the door and yelled to Uncle Caesar for help. He ran down the street. 5 minutes later, he was back with a doctor. The doctor examined Miss Adair and turned to the old black driver. "Uncle Caesar," he said, "run to my house and ask my wife for some milk and some eggs. Hurry." Then the doctor turned to me. "She does not get enough to eat," he said. "She has many friends who want to help her, but she is proud. Mrs. Caswell will accept help only from that old black man. He was once her family's slave." "Mrs. Caswell?" I said in surprise. "I thought she was Azalea Adair." "She was," the doctor answered, "until she married Wentworth Caswell 20 years ago. But he's a hopeless drunk. He takes even the small amount of money that Uncle Caesar gives her." After the doctor left, I heard Caesar's voice in the other room. "Did he take all the money I gave you yesterday, Miss Azalea?" "Yes, Caesar," I heard her answer softly. "He took both dollars." I went into the room and gave Azalea Adair $50. I told her it was from the magazine. Then Uncle Caesar drove me back to the hotel. A few hours later, I went out for a walk before dinner. A crowd of people was talking excitedly in front of a store. I pushed my way into the store. Major Caswell was lying on the floor. He was dead. Someone had found his body on the street. He had been killed in a fight. In fact, his hands were still closed into tight fists. But as I stood near his body, Caswell's right hand opened. Something fell from it and rolled near my feet. I put my foot on it, then picked it up and put it in my pocket. People said they believed a thief had killed him. They said Caswell had been showing everyone that he had $50, but when he was found, he had no money on him. I left Nashville the next morning. As the train crossed a river, I took out of my pocket the object that had dropped from Caswell's dead hand. I threw it into the river below. It was a button, a yellow button, the one from Uncle Caesar's coat.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Brian Lynn.